By noon this day, you will be dead men. 1,000 nations of the Persian Empire descend upon you. Our arrows will blot out the sun.
Then we will fight in the shade.
Welcome to the Objective Secure podcast. My name's Mike.
Hi, I'm Emma.
And this is episode 17, Casting Shade. We're going to be talking Shadespire today because we've got our hands on the box and we played some games now. And we're going to be announcing a few things that you may not have seen or heard if you haven't attended one of our events recently. But before we get stuck into the main topic about Shadespire, because Emma and I have been playing some games, we're going to quickly cover off some of the bits and pieces that have been happening here in WA and what we've got coming up as well. So, we've obviously been working hard in the background with our future events, so why don't we kick off with our first Shadespire tournament?
So we've got on June 9th, we have a mixed gaming day happening. It's happening in South Perth, which is where we run most of our events. And we've got our first Shadespire tournament happening, which is the Not-So-Grand Clash.
The Not-So-Grand Clash, mainly because we're sort of testing the format. We haven't run a Shadespire event before, but that kind of neatly segues into something we're very excited about.
But before we do that event, we're also running Age of Sigmar. We're running 40K with all of the FAQs implemented. What else have we got happening that day?
I think they're the three confirmed at the moment.
Yeah.
But all the tickets for those will go on sale in the next day or so. And players' packs and stuff will follow rapidly thereafter. They're just being proofread by a couple of close friends of ours. But we're very excited because Shadespire has certainly hit the gaming community quite hard since it was released back in October last year.
Yeah, so we were very lucky that we were able to showcase Shadespire in September last year before it was actually released. We had Shadespire at Southern Hemisphere Open, so that was really exciting to have that there.
And then was promptly ignored by the pair of us during the event because neither
of us
have
time to look at it. So, we've actually only just... I think you'd had a demo game a couple of months ago.
It was early in the year, at one of the stores here in Perth.
I picked up a model about a month ago at one of the stores, and a lovely manager there was very excited about the game and tried to convince me that we should buy it on the spot.
He did a good job. You were half there.
Yeah, I'm going to admit I started half there, so... Yeah.
And then through a mix-up, we actually ended up with a box ourselves. So we broke that out a few days ago when I assembled all the models. And Emma and I had our first games as we muddled our way through the rules.
Yeah.
And here we are. Now we're going to run an event because we know what we're doing.
Yeah, totally.
And then off the back of that learning, and like I say, the players pack for that is in its draft form at the moment because it is a different game system and we've got to kind of wrap our heads around the way to run that game. It'll probably be 5 games over one day. And probably 32 players is what we're looking at for the event.
We're aiming for 32, yeah.
And then come show 2018, we're going to have probably the next step in Shadespire. Certainly for WA, but looking at the Underworld's website, it might be it's certainly an Australian first from what I can see, but as Emma pointed out just before we started recording, it could very well be a Southern Hemisphere first.
Yeah, it would be fairly awesome to have a Southern Hemisphere first happening at the Southern Hemisphere Open.
So we are hosting the first Grand Clash for, ever in Australia.
Certainly the first one that we've ever hosted. So
yeah, which has been really exciting. We've been speaking to the team at Warhammer World in the UK and they approached us to run a Grand Clash, including all of the awesome support that they provide for the trophies, for the foil cards, the tokens, all the cool stuff that you would get if you went to a Grand Clash in the States or over into Europe and the UK. We will have them for Show 2018 as an official Grand Clash registered with Games Workshop on the Underworlds website and everything. So that'll be 64 player cap.
Yeah, maximum 64 players.
And that's they've been Warhammer World have been very, very good in regards to how they conversed with us and gave us all the information, and the players pack for that will be done by them, and they've been very clear in how they want it run and how many players and all the rest of it. So it's been really exciting that we're going to be able to actually be part of the standard they're trying to set for this game internationally.
It's a little bit tricky for us because it is a very different format with how they're running the or how they propose to run the event, and obviously we're intending to stick with that format. So yeah, we're trying to wrap our heads around how that actually works and what it looks like, because it is just, I guess, different to what we've done before.
Well, certainly. I mean, all the players packs for the Grand Clashes around the country, you can, around the world, you can find on the Warhammer Underworlds website. If you go to Organized Play on warhammerunderworlds.com, you'll find the ones that are in the States and in the UK. And so you can download those players packs yourselves. What's cool about that is you can start reading the format now. You can start getting a feel for it now. Mm. The trickiest part for us when we were looking at the sample pack we were given is that round five, the final round, is actually only for the... Literally, it is the Grand Clash. It is just two players. The
top two players.
So whether or not... I mean, certainly we're going to stick to that format for the official Grand Clash. Mm. That doesn't stop us having everyone else play another game.
Yeah.
So that everyone does get the five games in. But certainly, if you're not on the top table for round five, then you're not on the top table. So,
yeah, I guess where we struggled to get our head around it is that we've always done the Swiss style pairings for our events, yeah. But with 64 players, 64 goes down to 32 for the start of round two, goes down to 16 for the start of round three, goes down to 8 for the start of round four. How do you then get from 8
to 2?
We feel like we're kind of missing a couple of rounds in there. So we're missing a round in there. But we're going to follow their players pack. And
yeah, I mean, obviously we want to be consistent because they are, you know, Games Workshop and Warhammer World are the ones supplying all the paraphernalia and they're the ones supporting it and helping us promote it. So we're certainly going to be following the format that they lay out. Mm. It does mean that you're going to have to put your game faces on and win those games and win those rounds, and not just win them because the countback is on glory, but we'll get onto that in a second in regards to the game when we get to the main topic. So every game is going to count. Every point you score is going to count. Every point you give up is going to count. So it's probably the most competitive players pack and game that I've seen from Games Workshop, well, ever.
Mm.
It certainly goes hard. let's put it that way.
Hard and fast.
Yeah. Well, they've set it up so that they played four games. I think the one we've got here is an old Gen Con players pack. It's four games on day one and then just the final on day two, which for me, certainly Emma and I agree on this, it's going to be a one-day event. We're going to have the final on the same day because yeah. It's a bit counterintuitive to have two guys come back and play the next day without the hype from the lead up to that.
Mm.
So we're going to cut a little bit of time out of each round. That'll probably be an hour and a quarter, maybe an hour and a half, depending on how the day plays out for show. And then you'll get to play the final on the same day.
But we're not sort of making any hard and fast decisions around that. That's one of the reasons that we're doing the Not So Grand Clash in June. It's so that we get a chance to have a practice and we get to learn from that experience and we get to make some informed decisions around the timing and how it's all going to work.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Not-So-Grand Clash will be five games, one day. But again, it'll only be the top two playing for the final, but you will still get your five games because I think it's important that everyone hangs around and plays the extra games.
And everyone's there for the award ceremony and gets to celebrate together.
Maybe we just won't tell them which one's the actual Grand Clash.
No. Makes it very hard to do live streaming of the actual Grand Clash.
We're just
going to
put the camera over here,
but
honestly.
We're not telling you why.
So, we'll certainly be you know, learning from that event, and hopefully we can get the numbers to... I know the stores have been running fairly successful Shadespire events here in Perth, so they've had sort of the 18 to 24 mark in store, so hopefully getting 32 isn't a huge stretch for the day. But before we get too sort of deep into Shadespire, or Warhammer Underworlds, I should say, which is the official title for the setting, Shadespire being the first... I suppose the first place of combat, because we've got the 8 warbands now, and Shadespire is the setting for this version of Warhammer Underworlds. We'll take a quick break, and then we're going to talk through our first experience with the game, how the games went, look at some of the warbands, and maybe some of the tactics for future as we start playing it more. So let's talk Shadespire, or Warhammer Underworlds, I should say. I must stop doing that, because I suppose we knew it as Shadespire when it first came over for show. Mm-hmm. But we've, through a series of unfortunate events, actually ended up with an extra box of Shadespire.
I'm not sure as we'd call them unfortunate events, just unforeseen
events. We basically ended up with an extra one through a mix-up with some prizes that we bought. So here we are, we cracked it open, and... I built the two starter warbands and quickly picked up a third because Emma said she liked the orcs, or Uruks, I should say.
Yeah, so the I guess that's probably one of the things that I've heard a lot about is the ease of building the models.
Yeah, look, I mean, in terms of the box itself, I mean, we're going to talk Australian dollars at this point because that's where we are.
Mm-hmm.
$95 is the kickoff price for the starter set. And being completely honest, you need the starter set. It doesn't matter whether you just want to play the Uruks, you need the starter set, because the first and most important piece of any sort of organized play is the boards, because you have to supply one board each.
I guess the thing is, if you don't buy it, you could, you know, if you're playing with a friend, then, yep, that's fine, because each person only needs one half of the board.
Yeah.
And the box comes with two halves of the board.
Well, then if you were only to do that, you still need to buy the dice, because everyone needs the dice. And then you don't get the upgrade cards that you get in the starter box as well. So that $95 investment at the start is not wasted at all. Even if you're not necessarily going to play the two warbands that are in the box, which is good. And the assembly instructions were surprisingly straightforward. It's like a four-page pamphlet. I think it's four pages. And all in colour, all very easy. I think the most parts any one of these kits comes in is four pieces. It's basically the sort of two or three parts for the body and then the base, really.
Yeah.
And the models themselves are snap fit. They're all peg assemblies inside the torso, so you don't even need to glue them if you didn't want to. I know there are benefits for the Grand Clash itself, around painting, and there are awards for that sort of thing as well.
Yeah.
But I know that there's also been events where there's no... Like, I've seen guys rock up to an event, buy a box off the shelf, cut it all off the sprue, and just push it all together and then put it on the table straight away. So one of the biggest advantages for this is it is a board game with miniatures rather than a tabletop game.
Yeah, and just with the assembly, one of the... someone was telling me that they struggled with putting together Severin Steelheart. That was the hardest model that they put together, because you actually kind of had to hold certain pieces in place while you pinned them with the the torso. But really, compared to putting together any other GW model or miniature, it was not exactly that difficult.
No, I mean the that's a good point. I mean the Steelheart's the leader for the Liberator Stormcast. The model itself, the push fit component of it is really well executed. It's the way it's been designed means that the head has this sort of long peg that joins it to the legs, and then you kind of have to wrap the front and the back half of him, his torso, around it. If you don't slot the there's a sort of a wedge halfway down the bit that connects his head to his legs that only fits one way within it.
Hmm.
So if you click that in just the right spot, it'll all lock it all together. If you don't get that right, he'll still go together when you push the front and the back together. He just won't sit right.
Yeah, I suppose that avoids you putting the legs on backwards. So.
Yeah, it does.
Which, given that we had a Titan turn up to one of our events with its legs on backwards, is apparently something that you guys need help with at times.
Hugh, thank you. No, the models went together really easily. The cleanup was very minimal. Games Workshop have been really good over the last few years with their plastic molding technology where the mold lines are really well hidden. So you're essentially cleaning off the sprue attachments, any of the big flat surfaces like the hammerhead that on one of the Stormcasts.
Mm.
He's got a two-handed hammer. I can't remember his name. He had a big mold vent point smack in the middle of the hammerhead.
That's Oberyn the Bold.
Okay. So
just in case anyone cares.
He had a big vent point that had to be cleaned up and tidied up, and there was a mold line that ran around the hammerhead. But by and large, these models didn't have a great deal to clean up. They went together within... I spent probably an hour to build the eight that came in the box, give or take. And the Uruks took even less than that. They would have been a 25-minute job. They were pretty straightforward for the four of them.
Well, that makes sense. There's four of them. It would take you half the amount of time that it takes you to build eight.
Yeah, but like for this particular kit, like the there was way more cleanup on Oberon than there was on Steelheart. Because of the way Steelheart's cast, you're essentially cleaning up the shoulder pads, which is the other part of the Storm, talking about assembly, the two halves of the shoulders for all three of the Stormcast were separate front and backs, and getting that join to sit really nice and flush with a little bit of extra glue to help it kind of melt together and smooth out was probably the hardest part of assembly for them, because if you don't clean them up right where the pegs interlock inside them, they don't fit together flush. But, you know, they're again, way easier than any of the Games Workshop standard kits these days. The Blood Reaver side of it was really easy. Most of them were like two parts and the base. I do really like the fact they all come with fancy bases. They've all got sculpted bases with little, like how exactly where their feet sit so that they balance well. They've got little skulls and decorations on them. What was really interesting with them, with the Uruks when I was assembling them, is that half their foot is actually on the base. So you, again, they only fit one way on the base, but the feet are actually cast onto the base, whereas his ankles are a separate piece that sort of slot into the feet, which is cool. And the best part about that for me is it meant that I glued the entire model to part from base, which means I can spray them different colours and then paint them separately, paint the base separately, because particularly with the orcs and the way their armour and their legs sit, getting the base details around their feet would be a real pain if they were all assembled. So this will let me paint the bases separately and then slot them in, and then be able to paint them pretty straightforward as well. The other thing we should note is they are all in coloured plastic.
Yes.
Which, for a board game, if you're not a hobbyist, is perfect, because you've got the blue guys and the red guys in the starter box, and the Uruks are in a green plastic.
Yep.
I'm assuming that the other warbands, which we don't have...
Also different colours.
I don't know what colours they will be. Maybe we'll get orange for the Fire Slayers and like a bony colour for the Sepulchral Guard.
You're just making stuff
up. I am. But... I'd like to think I'm right, so...
Yeah.
But that makes it really easy from a playing piece point of view if you are just
starting out. You're on the green team, you're on the blue team, you're on the red team.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the assembly side of them, pretty straightforward. Any experienced hobbyist will have no problem with them. Any mums and dads or, you know, brand new hobbyists getting into the game, they're no more difficult to assemble than most of the board games out there these days which have any sort of scale models. So, yeah, props to Games Workshop for designing them so well. They do go together pretty straightforward. What else do you get in the box? You get the two boards.
Yes.
Which I really like.
Two halves of the one board.
So when you're playing organised play, you bring one of these boards along with you.
Mm-hmm.
I have to look in the Grand Clash pack. I don't know whether you're allowed to change which board you're using between rounds.
Mm.
Because they're double-sided boards. They're nice, thick card. They're all edged and wrapped really well, so that they should be pretty durable.
Should last.
And they are double-sided with different themes on both sides. I think there's two of them. Two of the sides have no dead hexes, and then the their opposing sides have dead hexes.
Mm.
And what I mean by that is they're essentially spaces where you can't move models.
Yeah. They're greyed out just to add extra layer of difficulty.
So the two boards themselves, though, lovely artwork, all marked nicely. And like I say, should be pretty durable for the game itself. We had no problem setting it up and putting it down.
I'd really hope we wouldn't. I mean, how hard is it to open a board and push two halves together?
Well, on the topic of pushing two halves together, they don't have to line up.
No, they
which
don't.
Is one of the interesting parts of the game.
Makes it a lot easier to set the board up.
Adjoining hexes between the two halves of the table. Mm-hmm. So you can have them skewed like a dog leg style, like a Z, or you can set them up like a T or a cross. There are a few different ways. The rule book explains it all, which is great. And it can make for some really interesting games where if you are facing like the seven Sepulchral Guard against the three Stormcast Liberators and you want to bottleneck them, it'd be very possible for you to skew the board so that you've only got those three hexes adjoining so that the Sepulchral Guard then can't use their numbers to get through the gap and overwhelm you. So there's a few different tactical ploys just by deploying the board before you even get to the game itself. Then we get into the actual game itself. And why don't we talk through the three games that we actually played?
Mm-hmm.
Game one took the longest by a country mile.
Yeah, but even having said that, what was it, half an hour?
We played the three games in just under 2 hours, all told. The first one definitely took the longest.
Yeah.
And there was a bit in the middle there between games two and three when we were trying to work out the cards and setting those up, which took a bit of time. But we still played three games in 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
The first one was purely the dice mechanic. No pushbacks, no triggers forever, like the no reactions, I should say, what they're called, where the characters basically power up.
Yes.
So we just literally put the models on the table in the starting positions, grabbed the dice, and went through the combat process, which is probably the most complex part of the game.
Oh, no, I didn't think so at all. Definitely not. Okay. No. No, not
we'll
at all.
We'll find out what she's thinking about that in just a second. That first game was pretty straightforward.
Yeah, very much. That first game was incredibly straightforward. No problem.
And
at
it was
all.
Literally he who killed the most wins at the end of that. I think I still had two guys on one wound left. So it was...
I can't even remember. I know I lost the third game. I think I won,
you
the,
won
second
the second one.
And lost the first, yeah.
So the second one, we added the pushback mechanic and basically did it over. And you didn't lose a model.
No.
And
yay,
chewed
me.
Your way through the... So and I had the Blood Reavers. And then after a bit of sort of unpacking of the game in terms of all the cards...
No. Hang on a minute. Oh, yeah, that's right. I've just written down my notes wrong.
There are two Stormcasts and two
I was playing with the Stormcast, which had three models, and you were playing with the Blood Reavers that had five.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We unpacked all the cards, had a quick read, and then we just went, you know what, we're going to do everything. We're going to follow all the rules, put the objectives down, score the points, do the upgrades, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that game still only took about half an hour to play.
Yeah.
And I know that we'd get quicker with it. And that actually, at the end of that game, was a comment from you saying, I only want to play one warband. I really like those models, and I came back with them the next day, which was the Uruks, which we still haven't had a game with yet. So, but they look, on the cards, they look really durable, which is going to be really annoying. So, from a non-tabletop gamer's point of view, how did you find those games?
The first two games were relatively simple. I don't learn through reading instructions, and Mike has a habit of he'll sit down at the table and we're going to play a new board game and reads at me. And I don't know why, because I stopped listening probably about 3 seconds in. So you'd think by now he'd have learnt, let's just play the game.
That's as much for you as it is for me.
Okay, well, next time you just read that in your head, because I'm not listening and it just annoys me having to listen to you prattle on. Because the other thing that he does is he reads the rules, but only reads the first line of the rule and then does the rest in his head, so which makes it very difficult. So I learn through actually doing, through watching and through doing. So I hate going first in any game, and we rolled off and I got to go first because I only had three models, you had five.
Yeah.
So that made it a little bit tricky for me when we were starting. It's very hard to learn through watching when I had no one to watch. But the first two games were really easy as far as, you know, how to do it. And the second game that we played, there was a little bit more strategy because I had an idea around what was happening. And the third game was still it was still easy enough, and anybody who's used to playing kind of board games would be fine with it. But it did get a lot more complicated and started to be, you had to employ more strategy, and your objectives change each turn. So that kind of thing added that extra layer of complexity to it as well.
Yeah. What I really liked about the objective side of things is that you do have some control over the objective deck.
Yeah, you get to choose whether or not you keep them or chuck them or...
Yeah, but also the game's only three turns.
Yeah.
And I know for a few of my my 40K buddies who haven't played this game, when I've been talking to them about it, going, this is awesome, you need to play, I've said three turns, and they've looked at me and gone, what do you mean? Three turns? I've gone, yep, you get three turns, round one, two, and three, and then it's done. And then you only get four activations in each of those, regardless mm-hmm. of how many models you have.
Yep.
So, yep, your Sepulchral Guard might have seven models in it, and you might be able to spawn more of them, which you completely can. The Skaven, I think, are five, and you can summon more. Doesn't matter. You've only got four activations each round. Mm-hmm. So you are in this weird position where you can't just be blasé about throwing models around.
The flip
Everything
side of
counts.
That is, yeah, you only have four activations. I was playing with only three models, but if you charge, you can't use that model again.
Yeah, and you can only make one move as well each turn, so yeah. You can't double move.
So it just, you know, then you're kind of going, well, if I pick up a card.
Yeah,
so.
you start having to use the decks to generate those extra actions. It does mean, though, as well, that later in the game, if you get to round three and you've got one model left and it's surrounded, you can just activate it multiple times to attack. You can only move once, but you can attack multiple times with those.
Yeah.
So that whole, essentially, it's you get 12 goes and then the game's done. I can definitely see two experienced players knocking a game of this out in 8 to 12 minutes, you know, including setup time. But realistically, you probably want 20 minutes to do it carefully and properly. I don't think you need too much more than that. I mean, we were literally two barefaced novices, and we still got through a game in half an hour without actually having any real prior knowledge.
Yeah.
The dice are pretty intuitive in the way they work. There's no numbers on them, but once you know what the symbols all mean and how they are triggered based on the cards you have, they all work pretty straightforward. The stat cards, I've actually got a complaint about the stat cards. It's all well and good now that I know what each of those symbols means, but I feel like that could have been made so much easier with a little piece of text underneath each of those numbers.
Yes, most definitely.
Because the first couple of games was us looking it up. Like, I had the book open beside us because there's two sets of stats on each card, one for the weapon and one for the... I suppose one's all the attack profile and one's all the defense profile is the best way to describe it. And then when they get empowered, you flip the card over and they've got another set of attack and defense profile.
Well, sometimes... so some of mine that I was playing with then had
different
two
numbers.
Options that you could choose from for your attack profile as well, which, just to add to that level of confusion, really.
Yeah, some of was it Steelheart who got a whirlwind-style attack? So I feel like those cards could easily have just had, defense... move, defense, and starting wound or wounds, just three words under the bottom profile that's on each card, and then a range, dice, and damage under the attack profiles. Because, and admittedly, after three games, I know what each of those is, but I feel like if you're coming in like raw, they would be really useful to have on the cards. And there's space on the cards.
Though I'm looking at it going, hang on, just let me dredge my memory. If we left it 6 months before I played again, I'd need to get the rule book out and go, hang on a minute, what does this one mean again?
Yeah.
So
I feel like that's probably a little tweak I'd make to these cards to make them just that little bit easier to introduce people to the game. But the stats themselves, once you know what those symbols are, there's not too much information on the cards. Like, I feel like the cards have got just enough on them to give you everything you need to know and still be legible in terms of the font size. The upgrade cards that you get throughout the game, nice and big bold fonts so that they're easy to read and put beside the cards.
Yeah, but with that, there's too much text on them. I don't want to know the backstory. Just
the
tell me what
text.
Just tell me what this actually does.
Not the fluff player over here beside me.
God, no.
I suppose the other thing we should mention before we get too deep into this is the space that you need to play the game. Even though it's only a two-player game, and you can play up to four looking through the rules. I don't I'd need to look further into that, but you probably want probably a meter by
80 centimetres.
Yeah, somewhere between 50 and 80 centimetres. You can do it in smaller than that, I suspect, but to have the ability to lay out all the cards so you can read everything easily and be able to kind of sort through. You end up with two different discard piles plus two different decks to draw from, mm-hmm. plus your 3 to 7 character cards, plus the upgrade space for their cards, plus all the tokens, plus somewhere to roll the dice because you don't want to be rolling it on board.
I think it depends what kind of player you are. Like for you, you are used to having that spread out in front of you. For me, I'm more of a let's play a game of gin rummy kind of thing and holding the cards in my hand, and so therefore need a smaller amount of space with that.
Yeah, look, maybe. I think that's a fair comparison. I also think, though, once you get used to what the upgrade cards in the deck do, you can minimize that space.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to know exactly what this named upgrade that only went on this dude actually did.
And I kept forgetting that stuff anyway, so...
I think Shield Bash is one that's vaguely ingrained in my brain, and it's not even a card I used. It was one of your cards, because we spent so much time trying to figure out what it did.
Yeah.
So, essentially, you set the boards up, you place your objectives, you place the models, you draw all your cards, and then you get underway. The cards themselves are probably worth a note at this point. There are two decks, the objective deck and ploy.
That sounds about right. And, of course, there's nothing actually written on them for me to be able to check. But I think it is ploy.
Yeah, the objective deck and the power deck.
The power deck splits into two, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's upgrades and ploys.
Yeah.
There we go. Get there in the end. So the objective deck is 12 cards. And, again, you can customize those cards because part of the game is building those decks.
Yeah.
The second deck, which is your power deck, is a minimum of 20 cards.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have a mix of... ploy cards, which are things that trigger in-game effects. Confusion's my favourite one at the moment, which swaps two models side by side.
Oh, I was so annoyed. I was so excited that I got to use these confusion cards, and then he used his confusion card
to put it back the way it was.
Again. Not happy.
And then the upgrade cards are special abilities or weapons and things you can provide the heroes throughout the game by spending glory. With the Grand Clash, which was really interesting for me to find out, you actually don't have to write your list. Obviously, you just declare what warband you're using because they are fixed warbands. But then you have to supply the deck list, the deck builds. And
is there an easy way to do that? Or do you actually have to go through and write out each card that you're taking?
I don't know. I mean, I'm hoping that on the Warhammer Underworlds website, there's something there that'll help you do that. But I think that there's going to be a lot of people that actually have to...
Sit there and
do it. I'm just going to open the website while we keep chatting because there is a deck builds component on the website, and all the cards have a symbol on them so that you know whether they're a core set which anyone can use or whether they're
specific to your actual warband.
Yeah, and then you can actually look on the website, and it's got the names of them all, where you get the card, which is good. And whether they're objective cards and power cards and what they all do as well, which is kind of nice. There are also links over here on the website that actually tells you the top decks from different events, which is kind of nice. So if you want to know some of the trickiness that goes into those decks, so there's one here, the Warhammer World Grand Clash 1, the top deck. And it tells you what objective cards he had. So there were 12 objectives cards there. 10 of them were from the core set. And then one was from the Sepulchral Guard. And one was from the Spike Claw Swarm, which is the Skaven Warband.
Mm-hmm.
And then his power cards are listed there as well. And what's really interesting is there's a couple from the Chosen Axes, which is the Fire Slayers. There's a couple from the Orcs. There's one from the Skaven. There's one from the Sepulchral. There's a couple from the Sepulchral Guard. But the interesting thing is I don't know what warband he was using. So it doesn't tell me that.
That's interesting because I thought you could actually only take the core ones or the ones that were specific to your warband.
Well, yeah, look, from the looks of this, I'm assuming that some of these cards that he's taken will... that the whatever warband he's playing, obviously it doesn't matter because he's using...
Okay, but they are...
They're not triggered by
right.
specific warband effects. They'll be generic cards that are...
Within...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's kind of cool that if you do happen to have multiple warbands, you can actually use a lot of those cards as crossovers.
Mm.
Of course, part of that is also a marketing thing. Like a purely a driven on growing the game, where you really want to have Bloodless, the objective from the Sepulchral Guard expansion. If that's the only place you find it, well, if you really want it, you'll buy the warband.
Yeah.
Not that that's a bad thing. I mean, if you bought all all six expansions at $50 each Australian, plus the starter set, you're still only out sub $400. And that gives you every card in the game, every model in the game.
It doesn't give you every card in the game, though.
What does it not give you?
Are there not the upgrade packs with additional cards that don't come in the...
No, that's the warband boxes. So when you buy the Auroch box, you get the Auroch specific cards and then an expansion deck as well, plus all the models.
Yeah, but I thought that there were, like, upgrade packs or expansion packs for the cards that were just the cards that were like $15 or something.
No, they were the card sleeves that you saw.
Oh, right. There you go.
So if you actually did want every card, every miniature, and you weren't fussed on special dice or card sleeves, you do it for sub $400 Australian dollars. But that's what I like about the game is that because it is expansion driven, so you will want other warbands, but you don't have to. You could do it with literally just the starter box. You could go and play in an event with just the starter box. You could go and play in an event if you knew the rules and you had access to the dice and some of the, like a board of some description from a mate.
Yeah, no, I thought...
You could do it for $50.
I was obviously misinformed, but I had thought that it was similar to Magic the Gathering in the way that you did the deck building and that you bought the additional packs and then basically it was a... random lottery that was within those packs and you could add to... Oh, well, that's pretty exciting.
Makes it... It takes the randomness out of buying the stuff.
It's not only taking the randomness out of it, but it's also taking the additional and ongoing costs out of it. I'm assuming that they are going to continue releasing more warbands or releasing more settings for the game.
Yeah, Shadespire being the first setting for Warhammer Underworlds. Yeah. But yeah, they definitely are. They've already said that Phase 2, which will be... Warhammer Underworlds something will come out and it'll have its own warbands and box sets and stuff. Mm-hmm. And the general consensus within the community when I've spoken to people about it is it should all be cross-compatible.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense for them to come out and then say, right, all these dice and cards and upgrades that you have don't work anymore. And if you want to play the latest version, all of this stuff essentially doesn't get used. I'm assuming all that will happen is we'll get new boards, which will make sense. You get a new starter box with two new
warbands
in it, which you'll want to buy because they'll have the upgrade cards and the new boards. And then you'll get six more booster warbands, which will have a bunch of new cards.
Booster pack. That's the word I was looking for. See, this is why. People use terms like booster pack that I know to be relevant to Magic the Gathering. Yeah. And I think, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Picked up a pack that looks very similar to the booster pack for Magic the Gathering. Turned out I was looking
at card sleeves.
Card sleeves.
So, yeah, I think like the natural progression for the game, it'll be interesting to see after they get through about the third release of it. Because if we get through, we've got Shadespire, we've got all eight warbands, like it's kind of self-contained now. Assuming it continues cross-compatibility, by the time you get through the third round of that, you're going to have 24 warbands.
Mm.
And I have to ask at that point, like, are we starting to double up? I mean, we've already
what I was just wondering. You've already got a couple of the Khorne and a couple of the... Oh, what's the other one?
The Stormcast.
Yeah.
Yeah, and admittedly, they've gone down the road of using the Age of Sigmar units to kind of differentiate those two warbands because the Khorne one, for example, is...
Blood Ravers and Blood Warriors.
Yeah, so you've essentially got, for those of you not fully familiar with AOS, you've basically got Chaos Marauders and Chaos Warriors are the two differences there. And then the Stormcast, essentially you've got the classic Stormcast with hammers and big bricky things, and then the
ones with birds.
Yeah. What are they called? They're the Fast Riders. So they're kind of the scouty ones. It looks like, and I haven't seen the rules for them, but it looks like they're slightly lighter armored. They've all got crossbows, which is unique in Shadespire because they're the only models that have ranged attacks.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, one of them's carrying a hawk or a falcon of some kind, which is cool. And I know that there is a unit of Stormcast in AOS that is armed very similarly. So I suppose it wouldn't be hard for them to then turn around and go, oh, okay, cool, we're going to do another Stormcast or another couple of Stormcast boxes, but focusing on different parts of the Stormcast yeah. army. And it'd be the same for
got,
a lot of them.
When you've only got five models or, you know, that kind of thing,
yeah.
it's easy enough to pick out a couple of different ones out of that same army.
Yeah. I think all of them have plenty of options to expand and do different things. I mean, the Uruks, you've got four big orcs in big armor. You could do a savage orc army. You could do a night goblin army. You could do a whole different range, squigs, a whole different range of them for the orcs, or Uruks, I should say. You know, they still haven't explored any of the elves or the A-elves. And we've now got the Deepkin for AOS being released. We've already got the Daughters of Cain. There's two other Elvish races that haven't been released yet for AOS, so I'm assuming that both of those will end up in the game at some point.
Hmm.
And then there's still no Seraphim, the Lizardmen. There's a whole raft of AOS that they can pull units from and then do really characterful models, which you can then use in your AOS armies, of course, as well, just by putting them in the units. It'll be interesting to see if we actually get proper AOS rules for these, because they're essentially all named characters.
Yeah.
I'm assuming the Sepulchral Guard and the Skaven will have generic Clan Rat A and generic Skeleton A, respectively. But, like, all of the Stormcast are named, all the Uruks are named, all of the Blood Reavers are named, and, you could just use them as fancy models in your army, but it'd be cool to kind of see Steelheart get proper AOS rules where you could take it off of the Shadespire table and put it onto the table as part of your Stormcast Liberator army. That'd be kind of cool.
Hmm.
And I think if you can get that cross-compatibility out of these models, then that's another tick box for gamers, because it means that, hey, I've got this model I painted, now I can use it in two different things instead of one.
Yeah.
But the game itself, I really enjoyed. I think my first demo game of it, I didn't understand it enough, and I didn't get a chance to read the rules and was left a bit confused.
Yeah, and it depends who... I'm not sure who demoed it to you, but I've got a relatively good idea, and if your style of learning doesn't match his style of teaching, then, and I'm not sure that I could imagine that it would, it can make it a little bit tricky. You're just kind of going through the motions, and I know you won that game, but you know, if you're just going through the motions rather than actually playing.
Yeah. Oh, look, that game in store was also a rushed game. I didn't get a chance to absorb anything particularly either.
Mm.
It let me look at the core models. It let me get a feel for how the game might play out. And that was kind of it. And I think that had it not been for the Grand Clash, that it might have been a game that I went, oh, that looks really cool. And that might have been the length and breadth of it.
Which is interesting, because it was our eldest daughter's birthday in April. And she's very much a board gamer. And I was saying, why don't we get her this for her birthday? And your response was like, oh, why would we get her that?
Yeah.
So,
I think the game itself it's not a big box game, board game like we've played with some of the other big boxes that we've got, where the kids lose interest after the second hour mark.
Yeah, and I'm going to admit I lose interest after 2 hours as well.
And I think that's the disconnect, is that this has all of the rules complexity of one of those big box games.
But it's done in 15 minutes. Yeah.
And I don't know whether that makes it good or bad for those sort of family game night scenarios where...
It's awesome. It's absolutely fantastic. Just keep it moving, keep it fast.
I wonder how long a four-player game would take.
I have no idea.
You'd need another starter set, of course, or you'd need to wait for the next starter set from Underworlds, which will probably end up on our shelf at some point.
I'm sure.
I'd be interested to see how long a four-player game would take. If you've played Shadespire and four players, I'd be interested to hear your stories about how that worked out. The rules seemed like they'd support it.
Well, have to, because there's options on the different cards.
Yeah,
with two players do this, with three or four players do this.
Yeah, but there's plenty of games that say it works with this, but it's quite... for me, the game feels like it's designed for two players, but we're going to tick a box that lets you play with three or four. And I always find with games that do that, and I can't say that for this because I haven't played it, But for those games that expand like that, they go, yeah, yeah, play with three players, play with four players. Kind of. Maybe.
Oh, no, I can see how it would work.
Probably the alternating activations is what would save it in that regard, because you're rolling dice at the start of every turn to determine who goes first. And then everyone gets one activation, then everyone gets their second, then third, then the fourth. So I suppose you're never out of the game unless you're going fourth. Because it'd be completely possible if you're running the three Stormcast to then have, and you're going fourth,
To have nothing left
by the time your turn comes around. So I'd want to understand how that process works for four players, because I think that's a risk. Particularly if that, you know, you start a turn two, you've moved everything turn one, you position turn two, you then start to go last, and oh, look, there's nothing left. But, you know, hopefully we can try that out at some point.
I feel like I need to practice a few more times with two players before I start thinking about adding in a third or a fourth.
Yeah. Well, we picked up the Uruks as an expansion because we went to pick them up from a store. Then they'd had an AOS Shadespire night the night before, and they'd sold out.
Of everything.
Literally everything.
There was one expansion pack left on the shelf, and it was like the most boring looking one going.
I thought that was the Liberators with the birds, the Fast Riders, I think.
No,
was the
they
only
didn't
one
have
left.
Birds because they're quite light birds, so I might have looked at that a bit longer.
Oh, okay.
I don't remember what it was, but I know.
It's probably the undead then, because they're the
certainly
skeletons.
Didn't have the dogs, because I would have looked at that and gone, oh, that's cool.
The demon dog from Margor's.
Fiends.
Muggles Fiends, yes. So that's three Blood Warriors and a Flesh Hound of Khorne. And that Flesh Hound is pretty cool looking. And you're going back to the models, and I know we're skipping about a little bit here. The models,
that's so unlike us.
The models are really good.
Well, see, it's tricky. The models on the website that are painted look amazing. The models, when they're in flat green, less exciting.
Less exciting, okay, that is true.
And for someone who doesn't play tabletop games particularly regularly, when I was playing, and I only had three models that I was working with, but trying to remember which model's which because, you know, oh, hang on, they've both got big hammery things. And, you know, so I find that a little bit tricky, whereas if they were painted and you can make them...
different.
Yeah, make them unique and identifiable, for me, I think that would help.
See,
I'm not going to paint them, but...
No, that'll be my job.
Yeah.
What I really like about the models in particular for me is that it lets me scratch a modelling and painting itch that doesn't require me to then go on and spend thousands of dollars on an army.
Yeah.
Like,
it's quick. You got three models, you got five models.
Well, see, Skaven is an army that I've always wanted and loved the idea of. A bunch of giant mutant rat men. Like, it's cool. I love it. The idea of painting 300 of them just
less exciting.
Is never going to happen. Yeah. Like, I know myself. I know I will lose interest in that project about a third of the way through if I'm lucky. And that'll be the end of it.
And then they'll move back out to the dungeon for 5 years before you decide to sell them to someone.
Yeah, or paint them more. Like, there are armies that do come out periodically and get more work done to them.
It is very rare.
My Harlequins are getting more work done to them right now.
That's only because you just bought new and exciting paints and...
Well, that is part of it. But anyway.
They're called template thingies.
The Spike Claw Skaven is five models. The Warband leader looks awesome. He's jumping over a big piece of sewer grate. I love the lieutenant, Kirk, the almost trusted. That is one of the coolest names going. And then you've got three generic Skaven, the lurking Skaven, the hungering Skaven, and the festering Skaven. Not one of them is the same. All of them are different and unique with their own, like the festering one's holding a dagger in its tail. The hungering one's got a big sort of flaily thing and a shield. And then the lurking one's got sort of punch daggers, Wolverine style. Each one of them is a little bit different. They've all got different armor. They've all got different feel to the models and how they present on the table.
Yep.
And it's five guys.
Yeah.
For me to paint those five Skaven to scratch an itch that goes, hey, I want to play a Skaven. Like, it gets that out of my system and it gets it done. It's the same with the Uruks because they're
another...
You
know that whole scratch that itch with the painting thing? That's what I'm like with gaming. I'm happy to have a game, but it needs to be short, sharp, and fast.
Fair enough.
So...
And even the Fast Riders, like there's only, I think, three of them in the warband. Yeah, there's three. So you've got the warband leader with a bird on his arm, and then you've got Eagle Eye and Swiftblade, which are two completely different models.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, if you wanted to paint Stormcast, you paint the three of them and you're done.
Yeah.
The biggest warband is the Sepulchral Guard. I think there's seven in that. And you've got the warden, who's a cool looking dude with a cape and a spear, the Prince of Dust, who's got a mace and a shield and a little crown on his head, and then you've got the Harvester, the Champion, the Petitioner, another Petitioner, and another Petitioner, and that kind of makes the warband up. But even the Petitioners, all three of them are different. One of them's sort of half digging himself out of the ground.
Could be herself.
Could be. This could actually have undead women in it.
Yep. Apart from the prince, which we're assuming is a...
Just due to the gendered title.
Yeah.
You know, the champion and the harvester are completely different again. And, yeah, I think the fact that all seven of these models are unique and interesting means that if you ever wanted to play undead, but you don't want the idea of painting that many of them, you can buy it, you can build it, you can play it, and... It gives you the opportunity to go to town on a handful of models and make them look awesome rather than trying to paint 200 of them and get them to a tabletop standard. Mm. And I think that's kind of one of the biggest appeals for me.
So you obviously don't need to paint it, and it's something that we haven't talked about as far as the Not-So-Grand Clash. Are we intending to have a painting requirement for the event on the 9th of June?
That's a very good question. Mm.
Nothing like putting you on the spot.
The intent for the Not-So-Grand Clash is to use the Grand Clash format.
Yes.
So whatever it says in there is going to be what we use.
And I think we've both understood that differently. So we had a conversation with Nottingham in which we both understood how the event would run differently. I understood that it would run four games. The fifth one was the next day with only two people playing. And Mike, you understood it, that it was Swiss style for the whole thing. Turns out I was right, so I was listening. That's always nice. I'm not sure with the painting part of that. There is an additional award that goes in for painting. I'm not sure if everyone has to have painted their army in order for the event to qualify for that, or if the people who have painted their army go in for that particular award and the people who haven't don't.
So just having a quick look at it here, the best painted warband in the Grand Clash. Many players will choose to paint and base their warbands for the Grand Clash. Of those that choose to do so, a heroic few individuals will go on to even greater lengths and produce a warband of such stunning quality that playing against it becomes a reward in and of itself. To acknowledge those few that go to the effort of making an incredible warband, the event team will scour the halls during the rounds, seeking out those warbands which stand head and shoulders above the rest. Once these have been selected, everyone in the event will get a chance to cast their votes on which they think should be the best. The player whose warband gets the most votes receives the Best Painted Warband Award during the award ceremony.
All right, so that's how I'd understood it as well.
Yeah, so it's
if you paint it, then there's the painting award that you're
It's not even
peer
if you,
judged.
Well, yeah, it's essentially peer judged painting, but it's not painting. It isn't enough.
No.
The essentially the organisers can cut it down to a handful that you vote for, which is actually really good.
Oh, I don't know. It's been tricky in the past when we've run our painting competitions that way.
Oh, look, one of the guys here in Perth, Cody, had his Sepulchral Guard in at Best in the West, which is a local Games Workshop store painting competition that they do across the state. And his Sepulchral Guard look amazing. And I think he finished third for the state when it came to the open category.
Mm-hmm.
That is one of those warbands that will stand out. Slapping some paint on them, putting base colours on them won't be enough. There will be no minimum standard requirements because that's not what the game requires. But by the same token, just slapping some paint on it doesn't mean you get the chance to get your buddies to vote for you.
So to clarify what I just heard, for the 9th of June, there will be no minimum painting requirement for the Not-So-Grand Clash.
Yep, we're going to follow the Grand Clash requirements.
Okay.
I had a really good laugh at some of this.
Probably the quickest decision we've ever made.
It could be, yeah. Okay. There's a conduct section in the Grand Clash's players pack.
Mm.
Wagering and bribery.
Oh, nice.
I'm not kidding. It's forbidden. Wagering is against the spirit of the game.
It's also against our...
it's against the law.
Yeah, it's against our license with liquor and gaming, so...
So that was kind of fun. There's also rules in here,
I'm not sure if I'm not sure if I shared this story, so I'm just going to share it now. So all of our events are generally licensed, which means that
we can
serve alcohol. And it's the idea is not supposed to be that people come and get absolutely tanked. It's just a social event where you can have a social beer with a friend and, adds to the spirit that way. But in order to do that, we do have to have a license. liquor license, and we get occasional spot checks from Department of Racing, Liquor and Gaming, and they came out to one of our events, and they came in, and it's a little bit daunting because if you get caught doing the wrong thing, there's massive fines. And even though we obviously never intend to do the wrong thing, there's times when you can make mistakes without realizing that you're making mistakes. So I was a little bit daunted by the whole thing and trying to be smiley and confident and pretend I wasn't absolutely having a massive panic attack on the inside. A bit like the duck on the water, nice and peaceful and calm on the outside and underneath paddling like mad. So, so this guy came in and one of the guys went to have a wander around and another guy came up to talk to me and he's saying, oh, so what's on the table here? So I'm trying to explain as best I can to somebody who isn't into tabletop gaming what's on the table. And he's like, no, how much are they playing for? And it took me a little while to work out. He was asking me how much people were betting on the games on the table. And I was like, what do you mean? And he's going, well, what are the wages for each of these? And I was like, oh, no, people aren't betting for this. They're just doing it. And he's like, why would they do it if there's no money on the line? I was like, no, they're just doing it for basically for props and to be able to say that they won the event. Well, what prizes do they get? And I showed him the little model and he's looking around the room going, really? You got this many people in the room for that? So, I just find it quite funny that these people had absolutely no concept that people would play this game if there wasn't big money on the table.
Oh, there you go. We don't get many that have bigger money regardless of any of the events.
No.
Yeah. On the topic of the miniatures, getting back on topic.
Oh, man. Let's focus. Fine.
So in the Grand Clash Players Pack, players may only use official Warhammer Underworlds Citadel miniatures in a Warhammer Underworlds tournament, and all miniatures must be fully assembled. Players must use the appropriate miniatures for their warband pictured on the fighter cards. Minor conversions, modifications to the miniatures to personalize them may be permitted at the organizer's discretion, but still must allow for easy identification of the fighter represented by the miniature. If a conversion is deemed to be too misleading by the organizer, or if a miniature is damaged or assembled in such a way that it cannot be easily identified, the player will not be allowed to use that miniature and they must use an acceptable version of the miniature or forfeit all of their games until they secure an acceptable version of that miniature. So I was talking to a couple of guys who really wanted to do Daughters of Cain style army and use them with the Blood Reavers rules. So the plan was to do basically a Witch Elf leader, a couple of standard Witch Elves with different weapons, and then a... what's the Witch Elves with the whips? I can't think of their name now. It'll come to me later. And then model them up to match the weapon payloads that come on the... come on the Blood Reavers. And I think that's a really cool idea.
But it turns out it doesn't sound like we can do it.
No, you can't do that.
Yeah. Shame.
Yeah, so while those sorts of conversions and those sorts of things are... Like, it even... The player spec even mentions it being sort of encouraged for you to personalise them a little bit. It really needs to be said that coming along with, Daughters of Cain models to try and count them as Blood Reavers or those sorts of things just...
Can't happen.
Yeah, can't happen in any of the official events. And I think it'd be cool to have as a... like, if I were going to do it, I'd probably put it together as close as I possibly could to the proper warband in terms of weapon loads and make them distinct, even try and pose them the same potentially. Mm. But I'd also have the standard Blood Reavers with me. Mm. And I'd go to the event or I'd send them to the organizer pre-event and go, here's what I want to do. Here's what I think. Even if the organizer agreed to it, I'd still be inclined to have the standard warband there with me painted and ready.
Most definitely.
It doesn't even need to be painted because the rules don't require it. So that if you get to the table and your opponent goes, no, man, I don't get it. I'm confused. You can go, yep, no worries, here's the other warband.
Mm-hmm.
Unless it's an official event, and then, no, you can't.
And our events are official events, and so, no, you can't.
Yeah, that makes it easy. So, the players pack they give you is quite extensive. It gives in and tells you what judges and head judges and all sorts of stuff are.
Mm-hmm.
There's quite an interesting breakdown. You've got organisers, judges, head judges, scorekeepers, players, and spectators. And then it goes and defines each of those and then goes through the rounds and the results and participants and what cards and tokens you're allowed to bring. And, it's really quite interesting how detailed they've been. It's like someone's clearly run events before when they wrote this initial pack.
You should hope so.
Well, Games Workshop haven't really been in the scene in terms of writing players' packs for a number of years now.
No, but if they're using playtesters from around the world that are running events, then I'm imagining that they have access to resources.
Yeah, absolutely.
That would allow, you know, somebody to make a players' pack that covers a lot of information that, I guess, tournament organisers should be including in their players' packs.
Yeah. What's really interesting is the pairing system, which I might go through very quickly now before we wrap this topic up. Mm-hmm. So for round one, pairings are generated randomly using player numbers that were assigned at registration. So yes, you are a number, not a name.
Beautiful.
If there are
That's exactly how I plan to run the community that we hope to foster here. Not that run the community, but to foster the community is you lose all sense of personal identity and you do just become a number.
Yeah.
I am being incredibly sarcastic there. We're working really hard to try and generate this sense of community and sense of identity. So we're really not into the whole assigning a number, but that's what it says. So that's what we'll be doing.
Yep. And it says if there are not a number of players, one player determined randomly will play against the stand-in player, which is obviously going to be Emma or I for the not-so-grand clash.
Keep your fingers crossed it's me, guys.
Or that we just have even players. That'd be
yeah,
great.
Yeah, actually, keep your fingers crossed for that one.
Then it goes on for subsequent rounds, pairings allocated as follows. They're split into groups according to the tournament score. So in the second round, there will be a group with 3 points, which is one win, a group with 0 points, which is one loss, and a group with 1 point, which is draws. Within each group, the players are then ranked according to the tiebreaker categories, which are glory points and the glory points difference and the games lost. Number of games is 3 per round.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you've done that, where players within a group have the same ranking after tiebreakers, the rankings for those players are determined randomly. The highest ranked player in each group is paired with the lowest ranked player in their group. And then the second highest ranked player in their group is paired with the second lowest player in their group. And so on. If a group contains an odd number of players, the lowest ranked player in that group is instead paired with the highest ranked player in the group below theirs. So if you are the lowest ranked winner and there are no draws, you play the highest ranked loser.
Mm.
So this is why we're trying to wrap our heads around to make sure we get this right.
Yeah, I'm going to need to reread that because that didn't make any sense to me, I'm going to be honest.
And then no player will play against a stand-in more than once. Players will not be paired with an opponent they've already played. It's a very different pairing system. It's certainly not the Swiss that we're used to. It is still winners play winners, essentially, but it's not going to be the winners who have the closest scores.
No, so with our events, what we generally try and do is we match on win-loss, but then we also try and match on game points as close as possible.
Yeah.
Whereas this seems to be saying match on win-loss, but then match with the furthest distance to...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're probably going to have to run this through the software that we have as a dummy run to see what happens with it.
See if we can do it.
I know that Best Coast Pairings have put Warhammer Underworlds in there, so I might have to get in touch with them as well because we've got about 6 weeks up our sleeve at the moment to try and figure out how best to make this happen. Maybe
to
it's
June
5 9, weeks.
It's like
4 weeks.
3.5.
It's not 3.5. It's only the 9th of May now. It's 31 days in May.
All right.
Anyway, let's call it 5 weeks.
Let's call it 4.5.
I think it's 5. I'm even going to check.
It's 4.5. We're on a Wednesday and it's happening on a Saturday or a Sunday.
Yeah, it's 4.5.
Yeah.
So the players' packs will be up today, except maybe Shadespire because I'm still trying to figure this one out.
We're still working it out.
So it'll basically mean that we get to try out the Grand Clash's format without actually having a Grand Clash.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll probably try and get some cool trophies for it as well. I'd love to try and get a damaged trophy because it's the not-so-grand clash. So that way we've got a really fancy Grand Clash trophy and a not-so-grand trophy.
We've got a broken kickboxing trophy in the back bedroom.
I just thought it'd be cool to kind of have something a bit different, that was all.
You're weird.
Yep, anyway.
We're not doing that, just in case anybody's listening.
Look, I'm going to leave the Shadespire topic before we wrap the episode up on some thoughts. Would you play this game with your kids?
Yeah.
Would you play it at a casual games night with friends?
Yeah.
Would you play it at a tournament?
If I wasn't
hoping
running
just to get a yes.
No, I did seriously consider playing at the 9th of June event. yeah, I did seriously consider it, but I have too many other jobs to do.
So what she's saying is that we as the community here in WA need to find people to fill in so that she can play her inaugural tournament.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I feel like I have a role.
Maybe you need to play the Grand Clash then.
Yeah, I can't see that I'm going to have anything else to do on that day.
It's only
of the show.
One day. It's fine.
Yeah, okay. Oh, my goodness.
So how old do you reckon? Do you reckon our 11-year-old son could play this comfortably?
I think our 11-year-old could play it comfortably, and I think our 5-year-old could play if we took the cards and the tokens and everything
I taught her the dice side of it.
Yeah, if we're just playing the dice the way that we played the first two games and just basically try and kill the other person's models, yeah, she could play that.
Yeah. Do you reckon the cutoff then is sort of that 10, 11 years old to get a fundamental understanding of the game?
It really does depend. Like our kids have played board games.
Yeah, we've been playing Catan, and we haven't been playing kids' Catan. We've been playing proper Catan and Fury of Dracula and some of those
Zombicide and that kind of thing.
Some of the higher-end board games, and they've been doing that for a couple of years now.
Yeah, then you've got other players who, you know, other kids play that kind of stuff from being 4 or 5, so the kids might be able to pick that up from 6 or 7, might be able to pick this up from 6 or 7. But then you've got other people who their board games run as far as Monopoly or Scrabble.
Yeah, which is a whole different... They're completely different. They're not even in the same... They shouldn't even be called board games because they are two different beasts.
Monopoly should be banned. Banned with fire and never allowed anywhere near families. Like, I swear that that's the cause of divorce and family breakups.
That is true.
It's awful. I know some people like Scrabble, like Monopoly, but oh my God, no. And to the
ringing endorsement from Milton Bradley there.
So much to the point that somebody was telling me that they love Monopoly, and you know, after they were playing Monopoly, they started playing Risk, and how excited. I won't play Risk now because that same person likes Monopoly, likes Risk. I'm not playing it. And I know we've got it, but I'm not playing it. I won't let my kids anywhere near it.
Yeah, look, Risk. Risk's an interesting game, but we're not talking about Risk today.
I know we're not talking about Risk, but I've gone off on a tangent. So, yes, would I let my kids play it? Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, so...
I think they would play it easily.
I think that's the best part of it. If you've got younger kids who maybe don't have the attention span or the time or the... you're not sure about their level of commitment to actually going to full-blown 40K or Age of Sigmar, this sort of game is great.
What I like about it is that you can simplify it.
So yeah, you can just take bits out of it.
Yeah, you can add small components in as they're getting used to playing more of it. And that's not just for kids. That's for people who are brand new to games completely. You know, there are different levels of play before, you know, you're not just having to pick the whole thing up and go to playing tournament level Shadespire 3 games in an hour and...
Yeah. Oh, look, you could certainly play this casually over an hour, just one game.
Oh, I don't think you'd take an hour to play it. No,
but that's my point, is that if you even playing it relaxed and
casual...
There'd
be a lot of wine happening.
Even playing it casually, it's not going to take you an hour, is my point.
Yeah, okay.
I reckon it's a half-hour game. It might even take you longer to muck about sorting all the tokens out and setting the game up than it might take to play the damn thing, depending on what happens.
Well, that's certainly what happened with us with the last game, I think.
Yeah.
I think it was probably half an hour reading through the...
To try and understand how the cards are drawn and all the rest of it. But look, Shadespire, Warhammer Underworld's Shadespire is definitely worth checking out. If you're even passing... If you're a board game player, it's a great board game. Hmm. If you have a passing interest in Age of Sigmar, that's even better. If you just like cool models that go in a game, that'll tick a box for you. If you're a hobbyist and a collector, the miniatures are gorgeous. They're single pose models, so you're not custom building them for anything, but they're super detailed. They're really well sculpted. They go together really well, and you could really go to town on the handful of models that you have for a warband. I think as an entry point, it's a great game. As a tactical tournament game, it looks like it's got a lot of depth. And that should get better and better and better as we get the other settings.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I did really like about it, but also really didn't like about it, was the objectives that you had. I know that we're wrapping up and I've just started another topic, but you know, the fact that those objectives could be so different really once we started adding in those different objectives, it did really change how the game played.
Well, I think the fact that you're meant to customize your deck as well. So
you can choose which objectives you have in your deck you want to go for.
So you might turn around and go, okay, cool, I'm going to take out all the ones that say I have to claim objectives 1 to 6 on the table, and I'm just going to go for the ones that say I need to kill you.
Hmm.
And you just load the 12 objectives in your deck with those sorts of cards, or the ones that you might turn around and go, okay, I'm going to take the all the killy ones out and just go for the scoring ones.
Yeah.
That changes the tactics and which crew you might play, warband you might play.
And what I enjoyed about it was that I didn't know what your objectives were and you didn't know what my objectives were. Whereas when you're playing the 40K games,
you
know what the missions are, you know what the objectives are. You're both going for the same objectives. Whereas one game I was going, you know, I had to claim objective marker 1, you had to claim objective marker 5. But we didn't know that.
Mm.
But at the same time, I had an objective that I needed to wipe you out and another objective that I needed to not die that round. So, it was just interesting how adding those different objectives changed the way that... So when we do the battle reports, I talk to you about how is your strategy at the beginning of the game based on what you're up against and what are you thinking you're going to do, how are you thinking you need to play the game. Whereas with this, you only have 3 turns... But that strategy changes each turn depending on which objective.
Whether you're discarding objectives and cycling, how much you cycle the deck as well is going to be a factor.
Yeah.
And in theory, you should never go through the whole objective deck because you've only got 3 turns. Unless you are spending activations to discard and redraw, you shouldn't go through that deck.
Well, unless you're actually managing to achieve those objectives each turn as well.
Yeah, then that's exactly right. Like, that deck of 12 cards should be enough for the whole game.
Yeah.
And it's the same where you're meant to have a minimum of 20 power cards.
Mm-hmm.
But when you factor it out and go, okay, that means I need to use 6 or 7 a turn.
Yeah. You actually don't really want to have much more than that.
No, because if you're after specific cards in that deck to do certain things...
You're not going to pull them.
You're not necessarily going to get them. So I don't think I'd go more than 24, 26 cards.
Mm-hmm.
And even that, I think, is probably too many. You might trip it over to 21 or 22, but I think too much more than that and you risk just not getting the cards you want.
That's it.
So anyway, go and check it out. Warhammer Underworld Shade Spire is currently available at, obviously...
All of your retailers.
Games Workshop, friendly local gaming stores, Warhammer stores. I'm sure that there's, the board game stockists around towns that'll stock it as well because it has been launched into that marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely worth checking out. It's a really cool game. I'm sure that you can find a local that'll demo it for you as well, whether it's at a store or just a mate that you might know who has it. If you're in Perth on the 9th of June, you're welcome to come down to the Not-So-Grand Clash and check out the games being played and ask some of the players what they think about it.
Either that or come down. Mark and I aren't likely to be playing, so you never know, in one of the rounds one of us could have a game.
Yeah. And we're also going to...
Maybe not, but you know.
We're also going to get some paint on these models in the next few days and start recording.
We're not, you are.
Yeah. And we're going to start recording some of these and putting them on the YouTube channel so we can start mucking about with Shadespire in a bit more of an organized play format with different decks and different warbands as we sort of pick them up and learn them. I really want to get that Skaven warband now. I've had a look at those models again.
Oh, my God.
We're going to leave
it. I knew this episode was a mistake.
We'll be back to wrap up the episode in just 1 minute. Well, that's our topic and episode for the day, done and dusted. I'm really impressed with... I really hope Games Workshop keep going down the road with these sorts of board games. I really enjoy Shadespire.
Hmm.
It might even see me having to buy Necromunda next, because they re-released Necromunda, and it's not a tabletop game anymore, it's a board game.
Hmm.
And they've just released my favourite crew from... gang, I suppose, for that game, the new Vansar. And I've got the old Vansar, the metal ones from 2nd edition when Necromunda was a tabletop game. And these models are freaking amazing. And that's going to be very hard for me not to buy that box, which means that I might as well buy the game that goes with it.
Yeah, you might as well.
I've got
that. That was not...
No, that, now I'm going to cut this and edit that, so that's what I've got.
Yeah.
Maybe I just need to turn that into my ringtone.
Mm.
You know, the look I'm getting at the moment is not a good one, people. It's not good at all. On a completely unrelated topic before we get going, I have been spending some more time. If you've seen any of the photos or the live stuff I've done with these Green Stuff World Color Shift paints, I've been mucking about with those now for a couple of weeks since I got them. And they've been really interesting to play with because they present their own unique little challenges and opportunities as to how they react on the models. We're going to get some more updated photos as I finish these three Star Weavers for these Harlequins. I've basically done three different colours across the three different vehicles, and they're probably a half done at the moment. And I'm trying out a whole bunch of new techniques. I'm trying out stencils. And I'm going to have to use the brush on them very shortly as well to start trying out how the brushwork with them, because they are airbrush paints. I'm also a bit concerned about how much paint I'm using is the other interesting part with these, because they're 17 mil shaker droppers, but some of them feel significantly light now that I've been using them.
Going, oh yeah, that one seems actually really quite empty.
So that's going to be a really interesting test, is that how far are these paints actually going?
Yeah, and it's something that we talked about as a positive for them, and I think I raised it as a potential negative at the time that we were talking about it. With the other, is it Vallejo airbrush paint that you've been using up until now? Although it says that there's no requirement for you to thin it, you still really are needing to use thinners.
Yeah, for a lot of the heavy pigment colours, yeah.
Yeah, which is frustrating in that you have to mix them and you have to make sure that they're well mixed and having to actually use the thinners, but it does make the paint go a lot further.
Yeah, whereas these are like...
they're spraying beautifully.
Yeah, they are. The amount of cleaning that the airbrush requires is only when I change colours, essentially. Yeah. It's
so
been really good.
No clogging and blocking or anything like that. But yeah, you are chewing through them, and they're not really the cheapest of paints.
No, well, we're very fortunate that, from what I understand, one of the local hobby stores here in Perth is actually going to be stocking them on the shelves very shortly, including a lot of the rolling pins that Green Stuff will do, and a few other bits and pieces from them, which is really awesome because it means we're not going to have to ship them from Spain.
Mm.
And part of that issue, of course, is getting them to Australia means that once they hit an airplane, you start having issues with temperature, which can ruin the paints, and they can get here and then be just completely useless. One of the first things...
On the upside, they're delivered to your door. You don't have to go out. And anyone who's met Mike in person knows just how long it takes for him to do anything because he has to stand and chat for 4.5 hours.
That's not true.
You're right. It's only 4 hours.
But it does mean that if I run out of one of these colours, I'm not going to be then sat for a fortnight or more waiting for them to come to finish whatever I was doing. I can potentially just go and pick them up.
Yeah.
Which is a blessing and a curse, I'm going to admit.
Yes, it really is.
So, yeah, it's going to be really cool if we do actually see those hit the shelves here in Perth. Once we do know that they're here, then we can obviously include that in a future episode so you can go and find out where and how and who. But I don't want to spoil anyone's thunder without knowing for certain that they are actually coming.
Sure.
So, we're going to leave it here. We hope you've enjoyed listening to Shade Spire. We're going to put some videos up soon once I get some paint on these models, because even though you don't need to paint them, I still feel the need to paint them.
Yeah, me too.
Just because I think it'll be more visually interesting to watch.
It is actually really funny, even, I don't know that I'm changing the subject again, but when we were playing Zombicide, I really struggle with playing that with that, with the bare plastic models, and yes, some of them are colourful and whatnot, but it killed me.
You got a plastic snob in the making here.
Mm, yeah.
So I better go and get some painting done then.
You've got some other stuff to get done as well, but sure.
I've got to edit this episode for starters.
And also the dishes need doing.
Yay, thanks. but we will catch you in a fortnight's time for the next episode. You can find us live on Facebook every alternate Wednesday in between these podcast episodes.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube... The website.
YouTube's a big one that I'm trying to build at the moment. So please jump onto YouTube, Objective Secured, and subscribe to our channel. We're trying to get our subscribers up, so that would be fantastic.
And we're going to get our first Shadespire games up, hopefully. We might even have to make it you and I against each other, because we can set up the mics exactly like we're sat now for recording, set the game up, and just play.
Yeah.
Oh, obviously we have to add a camera, because that probably helps.
It might do, because my description is... This guy with the pointy pointy weapons doing this.
Yeah.
Is possibly we might need a little bit more than that.
Anyway, guys, take care, and we will see you for the next episode. You've been listening to the Objective Secured podcast. If you'd like to get in touch, you can visit our website, objectivesecured.com.au. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/objectivesecured, or you can email us, obsec@optusnet.com.au. Thanks for listening.